At CEES, most of the people here haven't been to any other talks I've given, so I can use my one joke that I start out with when I talk about science and journalism. And it's a joke about, now some people, you might think you've heard this joke, but you haven't heard my version. There's a physicist, a philosopher, and a mathematician, and they're riding on a train in Scotland. And they're riding along and they're looking out there, and the physicist looks out and sees a black sheep and says, "Look, they've got black sheep in Scotland." And the mathematician says, "Well, they've got at least one black sheep in Scotland." And the philosopher says, "Well, they have at least one sheep that's black on at least one side in Scotland." Well, that's the original joke. In my version, there's a fourth person on the train, and while those guys are talking, the fourth person whips out this notebook and is scribbling away, and so they look over and say, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm writing my lead for my story. I'm a journalist." They said, "Well, what are you writing?" "Well, a half-white, half-black clone sheep, probably the result of illicit genetic engineering, was seen roaming free in Scotland today," a philosopher reported. And, you know, that kind of sums up sometimes the perception of journalists by scientists, but it's a little more complicated than that. And I'm going to talk about, I think, basically the basics of what goes on in science journalism, and would welcome, you know, interruptions on particular points to spark some of the discussion as we go on, because, I mean, you know, that's the way it's supposed to work. But first of all, I think, you know, the problem that exists, and I think everybody who does this and observes it knows there's, you know, less than perfection in the coverage of science in the media. Problem, I think, can be summed up pretty quickly by discerning an asymmetry. I think this is undoubtedly true, that from the viewpoint of the general public, both the science and the media are important things. From the viewpoint of science, both the media and the public are important things. And from the viewpoint of the media, the public is important. And there's an asymmetry there that causes a lot of problems. And when I get to the end of the talk, I'll talk about what that ultimately means for the problems that science journalists have doing their job today. To sum up, another way that to sum up the problem, I think, was a cartoon from a few years ago after Fred Friendly, the famous CBS journalist, died, who you know, tried to stand on principle in the world of journalism and didn't get him anywhere. And this kind of sums up the daily news meeting at many media outlets in America. But, you know, that's the whole picture of the media is too big to try to take on. I'm going to concentrate just on the science news part of it and talk a little bit about how science news gets in the paper. And mostly what I'm talking about has to do with newspapers, although it's broadly applicable in a general sense to some other media as well. But, you know, like television is, I suppose, important, and it is a source of science news, but A, I don't really know anything about television, and B, I think it's not worth talking about anyway. So where does science news come from? Well, primarily it comes from stuff published in journals, and that's, you know, just the way it is. There are aspects of that that are good, of course, because it's better than just going out in the street and looking for it, but then, you know, journals aren't perfect either. But that's a main source of science news. A not-so-important source of science news would be news releases that various organizations and institutions send out. For one thing, we never actually read any of those news releases. And unless the news release is itself tied to something that's actually coming out in a journal or being presented to me or something like that, it doesn't have very much weight in comparison to everything else. There are exceptions, of course, when a news release is warranted and is useful, but for the most part, it's not a good way to deliver news, and it's, you know, it's not something that is going to carry much weight. scientific meetings are a source of news. Not as much as they used to be. I think it's true, I haven't really tried to quantify it, but from my experience and from my knowledge of other people's experience, in the old days, you know, a few decades back, meetings were a rather more important source of science news. In the late 60s or so, maybe it was the early 70s, there was a person who's a science journalism professor now who did a study and identified, six, eight, ten middle-aged white males who constituted the science journalism community, and she designated them the inner club, and they would kind of go from meeting to meeting, sit around in the press room, decide what was the story that should be filed out of that meeting today, and it was pretty much the routine source of science news. Today, that's all different, meetings are not covered as much as they used to be just because newspaper travel budgets have been hacked all to hell, but they still sometimes, in some of the meetings, report, and I'm going to talk in more detail about some of those in a minute. Actual events, surprisingly enough, sometimes make news. I mean, if something goes to Mars and succeeds in landing, that's headlines, and that's still occasionally an important source of science news. And then there's the enterprise, where there are still some science journalists who actually go out and look for interesting new science on their own instead of having it spoon-fed to them by the journals or something. And there's not as much of that as there should be, but there is some of it, and some of it's pretty good. So a little more detail on those things. Yeah.
Oh,
sure. Yes.
I think you missed one, which is, for example, in this field, our ePrint archives.
Okay. Hold that thought.
Okay.
Hold that thought. I'll address that. Good point to bring up. Good foreshadowing. So the journals, of course, there's thousands of journals, and I read most of them, but a few might slip my attention. For most people, the emphasis is on a handful of journals which are known, I believe actually even among scientists as well as us, as the media journals, where you want to publish to get media coverage. And those are fairly well known. Science, of course. Nature and its ever-multiplying sibling journals like Nature's Materials, and Nature Biotechnology, Nature Medicine, Nature Genetics, there's a whole bunch of them. Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences has in recent years become a much more covered journal than it used to be and has a lot of interesting things in it. Some of it's even good. I'm going to mention New England Journal and JAMA, Journal of the American Medical Association, because those are also common. I'm not going to talk much about the medical journals or medical news. It's related and sometimes overlaps, but it's not my focus. New one, the Public Library of Science, which has its biology version out now, is becoming more and more recognized as a source of news. And this is all the open access journal trend that I think is good that they've started and is having some success in getting some worthwhile stuff. The Cell journals in biology are pretty regular suppliers of science news. Cell, Neuron, Molecular Cell, and a handful of others. Here's how we get the stuff from the journals. In most cases, roughly a week in advance of publication, the journals, in the old days it was like snail mail, and then they graduated to faxing, but now you just go on to the web and go to the journal page and you register with your media credentials to get access. And you go there when the new issues stuff comes out. So a week before publication, a week before the actual journal stuff itself is published or released online or whatever, we get access to it. Here's the Nature page. You see they list all their many journals there, and you can go there to see what's going to be in the journals. Now, you see, I thought I would check out, it says read news there, and I thought, well, that might be a good place to go. So I did that the other day, and fortunately that news, I think, is like news for journalists about what Nature's doing, not real news, so that wasn't so bad. Here's a typical week. This is this week's Nature, which is comes out tomorrow. And here's the list of some of the things. The ones at the top of the list are the one nature itself identifies as the items in that issue that nature thinks is most newsworthy. And then you go down to the bottom, you'll find, and also there's these other things, which is typically where the best stuff is. But you go here, you can get a PDF of the actual paper, and then you know the news and views that accompanies it is there, and you can see what's going on. Nature is, like all these media journals, is very into legalistics. And they want to warn you about all the terrible things that might happen if you step out of line. The embargo system is what I'm talking about. Most people, I think, are aware of this. The whole deal is when you agree to sign up to get access to these journal articles in advance, is you agree not to use it, not to print it, not to publish it until the publication day or the embargo time, like the afternoon before the publication day. And if you do publish it before the embargo time, you get severely reprimanded. They take your privileges away. They yell at you. They post libelous emails all over the place and pretty much try to intimidate you. But it's not as bad for us as it is for the scientists. If the scientists send something to Nature, they've got to agree not to do anything like tell anybody about it in advance or they'll never get published in Nature again. It's a terrible system. The embargo system is evil and should be destroyed. And I could elaborate at great length at some point, maybe in question period on that. But anyway, there's the rules. You can't do any of this stuff without... And then you have to be worried about the UK Criminal Justice Act and the US Securities and Exchange Act and all that stuff. They really try to emphasize that embargo stuff. Another media, PNAS is a similar system. They have a separate little page where they give the what they think are the top articles in PNAS, and then they give you access to the whole journal so you can go through. PNAS in particular, there's so much stuff in there. They'll identify four or five things, but there may be several other good things in there that you have to go find for yourself. Here's this week's highlights. Again, you can go get the actual paper and stuff. You go to the page where the actual papers are and download them to examine to see if you think they're really worthwhile. This is the Cell journals. That's the embargo on this is, that's for Thursday. we wouldn't want the embargo police to bust me here in the middle of the talk, but here's different journals that all these major media journals I mentioned all have some system now for A, letting you know, B, promoting the ones they like the best and think you should write about, and providing you access to the papers before publication. There's this week's Science. Well, you can't really read that, but just in case, that comes out tomorrow too. So anyway, from the journal standpoint, I think there's a point to be made. It's made very easy for us by these media journals to write about what they do because they go to great lengths to provide us this stuff in advance and make it accessible and tell us what they think, what we should write and all that sort of thing. So on the one hand, that's good. And it's a lot. There's a lot more of this than there used to be. 20 years ago, I think you basically had Science mailing stuff out the week before, and somewhere in that period Nature started doing it, and the New England Journal of Medicine, you had to like buy a first class mail subscription so it would arrive in your office a couple days before. But nowadays there's all these journals, all kinds of journals doing this. There's a much bigger flood of journal stuff coming into you. News releases, I just mentioned briefly, I get so many news releases. I no longer even open news releases that come in the mail. I might spend 2 to 3 seconds looking at a news release that comes in by email before determining that it is in fact a news release and killing it. But there is a service that I think AAAS was involved in getting this going. It's called Eureka Alert. And here's a page where you go to, again, you register with your credentials, and various institutions, universities, other organizations can post their news releases on this site. And so what I do, and what most of us now do, I think, is rather than pay any attention to releases that come individually over in the mail or email or whatever, is we go to this one place, this one-stop shopping, scan through all the releases that are posted. They're posted by day. Here's the ones that were, some that were for release the 24th yesterday, I guess, what was in JAMA, what was coming out of the ACS meeting, these things. And there's, you know, typically several dozen of these at any time that are released to come out in the coming week or two. So that's kind of where we look for news releases. And again, most of the time, the benefit of these releases is if they point out something that's coming out in a journal that, in a journal that you wouldn't ordinarily have seen. Like, I think I have an example here of, here's one that came out in Biology Letters. Well, that's not one that is big in providing us notice or that we would typically see, but the release showing up on here in Eureka would point us to this existence of this, and we might want to follow it up. Meetings, again, it's kind of unfortunate because I like meetings, but I think they're really a good place to go to find out what's going on. Not maybe sometimes necessarily for that breaking daily news story, but to get more perspective, more depth, more feel for what's happening in a field, what people are talking about. And that's, you know, it feeds into that enterprise category that I was talking about, because that's where you can get stories that aren't just these routine daily snippets that come out in the media journals that are typically, you know, out of context and not properly explained. Different kinds of meetings that I go to, or some of my staff writers would go to, or that other journalists would go to. The American Association for the Advancement of Science is the big interdisciplinary meeting where most of the science journalists in the world, if they go to anything and can only go to one, go to this one. Another interesting meeting, which is not the typical scientific meeting, the Council for the Advancement of Science Writing is a organization that basically it's a board that looks for ways to try to help science writing out. And its major effort is a once a year meeting. It's kind of like a seminar type presentation for the journalists. It's not like the other meetings where scientists are presenting to scientists and the journalists are eavesdropping. It's a program that's set up for people who are doing really cutting-edge work in an interesting new developing field or a new line of work in an established field, come and give people kind of a preview of what's going on and what's coming up in a new developing field. So the talks are aimed at the journalists. And you know, Santa Barbara ought to put in a bid for this. I mean, it only costs like $100,000 or so to bring this to a campus. And you know, typically 100 science journalists or so come to this and get a sense of what's going on. The asterisk there, when I call these meetings generic, is one of the other reasons. I don't think anybody goes to the AAAS meeting to find hot news, because basically there isn't much news there, but the parties are good. Other meetings that are probably more important from a standpoint of news are the basic disciplinary meetings. We've got, there's two major astronomy meetings each year. There's two major physics meetings, physical society meetings each year. There's the AGU, neuroscience meeting, chemical society meeting, other meetings, genetics meetings. Various other societies have the meetings. And so if you're specializing, as some science writers do, in less than the whole field of science, then you pick out the ones in the disciplines you're most interested in to go to those meetings. There are also special meetings. One of my personal favorites, it has Texas in the title, so I have to go to it no matter where it is. There's all my other favorite meetings. There's some, and then you also look for smaller meetings, workshops, things like that, where people are dealing with a more narrowly focused area that can sometimes develop into a good story. There's the division meetings that are more focused. Meetings on special topics, you know, sometimes you get, and we're going to have a future physics meeting here coming up, which sounds like it fits right into this category. One of my writers did go to the acoustics meeting once, which I think is an APS meeting, but that was only one time, and it was the year they held it in Cancun. So otherwise, acoustics might not make the list. So when you go to meetings, now this slide is actually a couple of years out of date now because the Society for Neuroscience did away with, this is only one of the two abstract books, of course, which was separate from the program book, which was separate from the media book. But this is typically you would go to the meeting and you would, before the meeting, you'd get the abstracts and you'd study them all thoroughly to determine which of the 15,000 presentations would be worth the story. Now it's all, you know, on a CD and you have to do it on your computer screen. You can't rip the page out that looks good and stuff it in your pocket, which is kind of sad. But I shouldn't joke too much because it is a serious issue. Here's an example of a meeting on a subject that's very important. There's a lot of important stuff, but it's a meeting where there's 25,000 scientists attending, and there's 15,000 presentations typically. And now, 90% of those presentations are no way in hell anywhere close to being newsworthy. But there's 1,500 left that conceivably somebody could write about. And yes, so you know, you're not, you know, 90% of that off, and you get 150 that you might really seriously consider. You might end up doing two of them. But it's not always that simple to decide which two or three or four things to do out of that much stuff. So it's a challenge, and some organizations and some societies are better than others at helping identify which are the things in this their particular meeting that are most worthy of attention. And so that can be helpful, but then you can't always rely on that either. You got to go poking around the abstracts to find stuff that's good. Now, enterprise, I mean, that's something that is a real varied thing, and there's a lot of ways to do it, but I will just give one example of the best way to do enterprise, which is to go to the ePrint archives and look at all the stuff that's going on and not yet in the journals, not yet necessarily ready for anything, but every once in a while some of it is. So this is a great thing. This is great because this is the total opposite of the embargo system. This is where scientists are putting their work in real time, making it available, you know, mainly for themselves, but it's great for us too to be able to see what's going on in real time, get a sense of what's going on in a field in these different areas, and you know, catch on to stuff on the upward curve before it becomes a big, well-known thing. So it's a great system, and it would be real. And physics, I have to say, is really so much better in all of this, all of these regards than some of these other areas, because the journals, physical review letters, the physical review journals don't have an embargo system. They have a good system of alerting us to important things that show up, but they just tell us, here's a paper coming up. If you want to write about it, you can write about it. There's none of this, you have to, you know, sign your life away to get to see it and then promise not to use it and that sort of thing. So the openness is really good for us. So, you know, there's all this stuff. I mean, all of what I've said up till now should leave you with the impression that there's all kinds of stuff out there to choose to write about. There is just a whole mess of stuff. And even though a lot of it isn't newsworthy and a lot of it isn't even any good, there's a vast amount of really good, important stuff out there that we should be telling people about. That's our job. And you know, I maybe should have said, underlying everything, the whole philosophy here is from a science journalist standpoint, and from my standpoint particularly, as science journalists, we're supposed to be telling people, the public, what scientists are doing. And I said that once at a group, you know, at a big meeting with a bunch of scientists, and the response is, we knew it, you're out to get us. I said, no. I mean, only if you deserve it. I mean, the point is not that science journalism should be a, you know, adversarial thing. the point, but it should also not be a cheerleading thing either, which some science journalists think it is, and even have said that. I think that's baloney. That's not the job of journalism. We're not supposed to be cheerleading for science. We're supposed to be telling people what scientists are doing. And to the extent that scientists do good stuff, which a lot of them do a lot of, that should be reflected in what we cover, and it should come across as scientists do good things. Now, on the other hand, to the extent that there's some bad, dumb, other stuff, that should also be reported. That shouldn't be a one thing or the other situation. It should be a fair reflecting of what scientists are doing, what's up, that comes out in the media. So, I mean, it's the idea is to tell people what scientists are doing, and that's the bottom line in the foundation of everything. But so if you translate that into specifics about what does it mean to make something newsworthy, well, the most important thing is it'd be new. But new could be a lot of stuff that isn't really also newsworthy. It has to also be interesting, and it should also be important. I mean, those are the three pillars. If I have an intern coming in like I do every summer, and typically they have science background, but they're shaky on the news, this is the thing you tell them when they're trying to go find stories. You want to find something that's new, interesting, and important. Now, the higher it rates on those three scales, the more likely it is to be a worthwhile story. I mean, if it's really, really new and really, really interesting, maybe it can be down a little on the importance. Or if it's really, really new and really, really important, it might even be a little boring, but you still might do it. But some combination of these three factors has to come out high. New can be a lot of things. It's the first incidence of something or the first evidence for something or whatever. It can be about something familiar if there's a new twist. This is, you see a lot of animal stories like that where, something, you find out something new about cats, you can pretty much make a story out of it. And there's the est factor. This is an important quick way to determine whether it's newsworthy. If it falls into one of the est categories, you got a good chance of making it into a story. I'd say I don't have light. I think today there's a new extrasolar planet that's the lightest extrasolar planet yet. So extrasolar planets are no longer news, okay? I mean, there was one yesterday that there must have been 7 or 8 news releases from every organization in America that had anything to do with this telescope system that spotted an extrasolar planet, and they really saw. I think space.com actually did it, but everybody else is saying, yawn, it's just another extrasolar planet. We got, too many of them already. But today, there's one that's just like 14 Earth masses. It's the lightest. Yeah, so that one you perk up and say, okay, now we can do something with that. So that's a factor. Interesting, interesting is pretty self-explanatory. Things can be interesting in different ways. You look for stuff that is related to readers' lives or interests, and you're serving the reader. It doesn't necessarily mean it has to be something that affects what they'll eat for breakfast tomorrow. It can be just something that addresses things they happen to be interested in. Readers are pretty interested in this stuff. This is a myth that is, I think, perpetuated by a lot of, newspaper editors, I suppose, who don't really appreciate the fact that the people out there reading the newspaper actually have interests other than war, crime, and politics, and sports, even. There's some tendency among people in the newspaper business to really have a pretty narrow perspective on what people are interested in. And in fact, people are much more interested in science, even, non-practical application science, astronomy, stuff like that. There's enormous interest in that. People, every readership survey I've ever seen shows science, at least construed broadly, if you say like science, medicine, environment or something, that category always scores higher than sports in reader interest. Anything that's unusual, surprising, funny, whatever, that helps make it interesting. Things are important if they affect a lot of people, if they might help cure a disease, and most often if it's somebody spent a lot of money on it or somebody's likely to make a lot of money off it, that makes it important. So then what happens? Okay, so we've got all the sources of stuff coming in, all these possibilities. We sift it through this filter to see what's newsworthy, and we decide to do something. What happens then? Well, the process is a little bit different from in any given place. There's always nuances about how things are set up and done, and one paper to another and everything, and editor-writer relationships are all different. But basically, the reporter writes a story, then an editor edits the story, then the editor tries to establish superiority and power over the reporter. The reporter then attempts to trick the editor into that naive belief that the editor has any authority or power. And then the story goes to the copy desk. And this is where things differ from paper to paper, how that process works. But typically, there's an editor who is somehow supervising the science reporters. That may or may not be a science editor. More often than not, it's not a specific science editor like it is with me at our paper. It's more likely an editor of some other sort, like the city editor or the national editor or something. But however that is done, then the story will go to some desk where copy editors do a final copy editing job on it. And this is part of the process where the space is allocated in the paper. I don't want to trash copy editors. Some of them are good and some of them are conscientious. A lot of them do make a lot of mistakes and change things to cause things to be wrong. So a lot of time when you see something in the paper that's a story that's stupid or wrong, it's not because the writer did it that way, or it's because somebody changed something that, and somebody shouldn't have done it, and they changed it. But the way the system works, particularly on the stories that are in the daily paper, daily news, once the reporter and the first, sometimes the reporter never sees it after the first try through. If it's working better, there's some give and take between the reporter and the reporter's immediate editor right away with that griping out and stuff. But whether that happens or not, then it goes on to the copy desk, and the reporter is never going to see it again. The reporter is going to have no idea what happens between 6 o'clock at night when the reporter finished the story and, 11 o'clock at night when the paper first edition is being printed and loaded into trucks. So it's often the copy editor that's to blame, and I believe that's the official company line that you're always supposed to say. But there are times when the copy editors find things and help you out. And then the copy editor writes the headline. So again, the reporter only rarely would know what the headline is on the story. And this is, a source of a lot of problems, because not only can the headline be wrong, even if a headline is just written in a slightly misleading way, it can change the way the story is perceived. And it's a necessary logistical problem in putting out a newspaper every day, every 24 hours. It's, it's assembly line kind of thing. It can't be done otherwise, but it does happen. Yeah?
Why didn't the editor, the reporter, come up with the headline?
Because you don't know what the size of the headline is going to be. See, at the time of day when the reporter and the editor are griping at each other, other people are there looking at where the ads are on the pages, and they said, how much room do we have for this stuff today and all that. They have to design these other pages and then assign, okay, we're getting a story on this. It can go on this page. It's going to be this long. It's going to have a headline that's one line across, three columns of type across. But that's all happening at the same time the other stuff's happening. And that information goes to the copy editor at the same time the story is coming to the copy editor. At the time the editing is going around the first time, rarely does anybody have any good idea what the size of the headline is going to be. That all these pieces fall into place at precise times all through the day and into the evening. So that's what I mean. It's logistically unavoidable. Now, it is different in the weekly science sections. We have it's not an exclusively science section, but in the Monday lifestyle section in our paper, we have space to put our bigger stories in my weekly column that I write. That stuff we have more control over. That stuff, that's done. The Monday section that we do is all put together on the preceding Friday. We go over it. We read the proofs, we fix it, we write our own headlines sometimes in our department, and so there's less problems when you do it that way. But that's just that weekly, one time a week stuff. For the daily stuff, there's no way to avoid this problem. So the last few minutes I want to talk about before I really open it up, and I hope you know want to discuss some things, is this relationship between scientists and journalists. And this is a report that came out a few years ago that did a pretty good job of identifying the basic issues. I don't think the solutions they suggested went very far or were very practical, but the identifying some of the situations that occur, I think they did a good job. One of the things they did was they surveyed a lot of scientists about their complaints about journalists. And, you know, they give questions, do you agree with this complaint and stuff? So 91% of the scientists surveyed agreed that journalists lack understanding of complexities or the tentativeness as results. 88% agreed that journalists were more interested in sales than in telling the public what it needs to know. And you know, on the first one of these, I think that's not so unfair. There is, I mean, certainly a lot of journalists don't understand things as well as they might or should. Second one, though, is totally bogus because very few reporters are interested in sales. That's higher up in the chain. I mean, the people who run the paper are interested in sales. The reporters are interested in getting their story on page one, getting, you know, a raise, getting out at five that day, whatever. I mean, they don't think about sales. I mean, I suppose in some really distantly connected sense you could say maybe, but not really. I mean, that's just not in the mindset of the reporters and the lower level editors doing the actual work. Focusing on the trendy, 79% agreed with that. Seek the sensational. Well, you know, seeking the sensational is not the same thing as sensationalizing the unsensational. It would be a better criticism to say, you know, the sensationalized stuff that shouldn't be. But if there's something sensational, you ought to be finding it out and telling people. I mean, I think that's kind of a lame criticism, too. And can't interpret results. Well, yeah, that's probably true. Now, they surveyed journalists also to see what journalists' complaints were about scientists and vice versa. But I threw that out. You'll notice this is singular here. This is not the survey results. But if you look at my criticisms of the scientists, you'll see that my perspective is not really worlds apart from the scientist's perspective. So, the other thing I want to point out, though, which I think is the root of what possible collision there is between science and journalists, is in the scientific community, while there is a growing awareness, I think, about the importance of communicating with the media, there is still a lot of resistance to communicating with the media. All those criticisms that I showed, however valid or not valid, and some of them are valid, and there are other criticisms that are valid, using those criticisms as an excuse or reason not to communicate with the media only makes all the problems worse. And that I think a main problem in the whole business is that there is still this reluctance among scientists to communicate with journalists, but worse than that, there's still a lot of condemnation of the scientists who are willing to communicate. And that's a bad thing. I mean, at the very least, if somebody doesn't want to communicate, they should just go off to their office and shut up and not be criticizing, especially the younger scientists who are making a serious effort to try to help the world out by communicating about what they're doing to journalists. I mean, I'm not saying there maybe aren't some journalists out there who you probably should all never talk to again, you understand, but just who deserve it. But in general, it is an important thing for scientists to communicate. And, you know, some scientists do really well at it, but a lot really don't. And here's an example. This is one example, and this is not, you know, directed at any particular scientist. This is just kind of directed at the system. This was the title of a paper that had showed up on the Los Alamos preprint server a few years ago, which I thought, this is great. You know, scientists really can come up with a good title for the paper and write an interesting paper. The paper was accepted in Physical Review Letters, I believe. But this was the title that appeared in Physical Review Letters. Now, I'm sure it wasn't the author's idea to change the title. And in fact, then I looked a little closer. Here's the beginning sentences of the original paper, the preprint. And you know, this is fine. I mean, this isn't stupid and simplistic. It's just readable and clear, and it's making a point that an intelligent reader can pick up this paper and read it and start to get something out of it worthwhile. Many attempts to understand the problem. There's no biological equivalent of hydrogen. You know, we understand there's this. That's fine. You know, that's good. Here's the corresponding first paragraph or so of the published version. And you know what? you see what I mean? I mean, you know, it just does not accomplish anything that I can see other than... Well, I don't know specifically what happened, but to get the paper accepted, this is the difference between the preprint that showed up before the paper was accepted and published and what, you know, presumably the journal editors made them do to get it published and accepted. Okay? In any case, whatever the details of how that worked out, you know, it might be worth pursuing at some point, but there's, you know, there's lots of examples of sorts of things where the communication, where for some reason, whether it's to please the journal editor or to please somebody or whatever, the language is changed in a way that unnecessarily inhibits, you know, the communication between the science and scientific community and people who are interested in telling people what scientists are doing. So, you know, this is just an example, but... Well, that would be a legitimate point. Yeah, I don't think that's the case here, though. I mean, the looking through the whole paper, I mean, I just picked out this as an example. Like, other passages through the paper were similarly changed. And, you know, yeah, true. I mean, if that clever introduction turned out to be a bait and switch, that's a legitimate complaint. But this was just recasting it from, you know, conversational clear language into, you know, more, you know, academic, I guess, or whatever. So the last point, which I alluded to in the title, was about one of these ships sinking. And I could possibly be accused of being an alarmist and possibly have a negative attitude. But I would point out, I'm only saying that the science journalism ship is sinking, whereas journalism itself, I've long said, is already dead. So in some ways, this is an optimistic point of view. There's still hope, you know, to bail it out, but somehow over the last, I don't know, 20 years, certainly between the 60s and, you know, the late 90s and today, something really strange happened in the world, and I'm not sure exactly why or what it was, but money became more important than anything else, as opposed to just something that was really important. And my favorite example, which has nothing to do with science journalism, I don't think, is in the 60s, kids bought baseball cards, you know, and they played with them, they stuck them in their bikes to make noise and all that stuff. Today, kids buy baseball cards, put them in these little envelopes, hide them away so they'll be pristine. They pull out their book of baseball card values and calculate their investment returns. These are 12-year-old kids. And, you know, so the same kind of thing has gone on in journalism. And what it's meant is that not only, it's not even just the bottom line, it's more the stock price. It's like, 1 year, a few years ago, we had a record year for profits in the company that owns the paper. And what that meant was the next year we had to cut our budgets because it was important to show an ever-increasing growth in profits, and the only way they could do that was cut the budget for next year. So they made the most money they ever made. That was bad for us. We had to cut our budgets. And so that's just one of many complicated factors going on in all this, of course. But when the budget gets cut, science suffers disproportionately because it is perceived as not as important thing to cover as war and crime and politics. So while the economics of newspapers lately and news media in general have been getting worse and worse, that has meant that science has struggled more and more to maintain its standing in terms of resources and stuff. And so I think the future is kind of bleak in that case, in the sense, especially newspapers. It may be that other media come along, newspapers die, there's more electronic stuff, and science journalism will come back, but I don't see any signs of that really happening. I think economic pressures affect all these media. When we're reporting in the paper, then we'd have not nearly as much staff as we need to cover all the stuff that's worth covering. If we had the staff, there wouldn't be space in the paper to write it every day. We have no support from the standpoint of appreciation or understanding of the need for more science. I mean, people who run newspapers typically come from different kinds of backgrounds that do not include science. They're typically people who didn't like science in school and therefore have concluded nobody likes science. However wrong that is, it affects the general attitude of the paper and papers in general. I'm not picking on my paper. This is a pretty general thing. Science coverage has a hard time making its case in competition with all the other things that newspapers try to do. And the bottom line main problem is advertisers don't flock to the paper to say, we want to buy ads in your science section. So you'll have papers, most papers have big travel sections, big house and garden sections, things like that, because there are advertisers. You know, there's airlines and cruise tours for the travel section, and there's nurseries and home builders and things for the house and garden section that come in and say, we want to buy ads in this section. So those sections get lots of space every week, lots of pages. Science doesn't get that space because we don't have those advertisers coming in, and that's the kind of thing that drives the decisions about how space is allocated. So I think all these things are kind of coming together in a way that's making it harder and harder for good science journalism to get done. And was there a solution? Yeah, well, if for every paper somebody would come along and say, yeah, I've got $1 million a year I'll put into advertising in the science section, then we'd be a lot better off. But that's not happening, and the way things are going these days, I don't think there's much prospect for that. So I suppose that it would be unfair to say that science journalism is dead, because there's still a lot of very good science journalism going on. And in some ways, and depending on how you look at it and quantify it, there's as much going on as there ever was. But there was never all that much, and certainly never as much as there ought to be. And compared to how much there ought to be, we're just really in bad shape. So I just want to do one quick little thing just for fun, because I tried to think a lot of times about what would really make a difference. And I decided, well, if science were more integrated into popular culture, you know, the way entertainment is, they get a lot of coverage and stuff. And other things get a lot of coverage because they're integrated into popular culture. I said, what we need are to have around the country science-themed restaurants. And maybe that would help. So I made a list. I made a list of science-themed restaurants that I think should be franchised. And actually, this one, I think somebody told me there was one. I think it was like in Santa Cruz or somewhere. And if this were accomplished, maybe some of our problems would be solved. Anyway, I'm open for any questions.
Yeah. I wanted to ask, trying to put together a few of the things you said. So clearly, this is a really vital issue for our country, science literacy and so on. And the press has a huge role in it. Now, you mentioned the statement that if you take polls, that people they are more interested in, well, science in combination with other things than sports. Right. Of course, there's a daily sports section in most newspapers, but hardly a weekly sports section in those. So I'm wondering what really is behind that. And you mentioned advertising, but presumably the sales department could, go out and tell advertisers, hey, look, we have all this interest in science and so on. So that That seems like that ought to be part of their job. So what's really going on?
Well, okay, yeah, sports is a special case because, yeah, sports does not necessarily attract lots of advertising, but sports is something that has this perception of being a vital part of selling the paper to have, you know, circulation. And it's not entirely wrong. I mean, there are a lot of people who buy the paper for sports. And it was especially true 20 years ago, say, that if you really boosted your sports coverage, you really, that's one of the ways the Morning News beat out the Times Herald in the newspaper war, was really boosting sports coverage. People who were interested in buying the paper for sports, people interested in sports, they could get all this information they couldn't get anywhere else. Well, nowadays that's no longer true. You can get all that information 24/7, multiple different ways. And but the perception has not diminished among people who run newspapers that sports is still the king of circulation. And I'm not advocating that they do away with sports. It is still important as an element of getting that segment of the audience. I'm just saying there's another segment of the audience that's just as big that's probably not buying the paper as much as sports fans are because we're not doing it. Now, sports has at least 10, probably 12 times the number of people that my department has, and probably more than that. It's at least 10 and maybe even more. Of course, they're doing a big section every day. If I had that many people and I could find that many good people, we could easily write enough. There's enough science going on in the world to write about it every day, too. I'm not advocating that necessarily. You'd have to stretch for some of the stories, but you could do a lot more. You could do a lot more, especially in some of the medical-related areas that we would get into and, you know, things. But the institutionalized structure of the division of allocation of resources in the paper is such that it's kind of historically built in. Sports is big, business is big, Metro desk is big, other desks are little, and there's too much inertia to try to flip that. I mean, it's just, and the people who are in the decision-making power places don't appreciate that it ought to be flipped. It's just beyond their experience. So, yeah.
Just a few days ago, yeah. I read an article in the New York Times about how much trouble the comics were because of various decisions.
Yes.
Newspaper print in the world. Mm-hmm. But there was also stories about how people were writing in complaining when Barry Worth was cut.
Right.
And so forth. So what kind of feedback do you get from the public, right?
Well, I get quite a lot, and I don't think it, you know, I mean, if you maybe not in the same numbers that you would get if you would, when we cut some comics and got complaints about that, but certainly enough to give you a representative idea that there are people out there who are paying attention and concerned. When we had a bigger full-scale section that was killed 3 years ago or 3 or 4 years ago, got a note from a junior high school kid, a girl in junior high school, who was devastated. Because, you know, every week she went to science class and was supposed to come in discussing some things about science that was in the paper. And this is, she, you know, grabbed this section every week and there's all this great stuff she could go and talk about. And, you know, it was cut way back and she was devastated by it. And I think the main thing I get from the feedback is the diversity of people. And I got a nice email from an 82-year-old woman the other day about something I'd written. I think it was the column where I quoted your paper on the anthropic principle, actually. And and she was thrilled because it was the sort of thing that gave her something to think about. And there was, and a similarly, you know, an old guy, you know, from a nursing home who was upset about the bigger section getting killed because when all his 85-year-old friends got together and talked, that was the only thing they had to talk about. So, and then kids, lots of people who are not, I mean, you get a lot of feedback from people who are also scientifically inclined or technically trained or people from the other community too, but you get an awful lot from people who just find the stuff interesting and are not interested in the other stuff. So you get lots of diverse feedback from people, lots of people who would like to see more of it, but they don't carry the same weight as, you know, somebody who's going to come in and buy a lot of advertising or somebody who's, you know, more familiar to the people who are making the decisions.
There's a thing, a about the special role of newspapers, which people have been predicting are going to disappear anyway, and then they're actually surviving longer than I expected. When I thought about it, it's things like sports, comics, classified ads, even ads that keep them alive.
Obituaries.
It's harder for a computer or multiple sources to cover. So sports, for example, that you have tables, lists, competitions.
Mm-hmm.
Each day is very, is incremental. It's you're going back to the same thing over and over again, adding a little bit, and you can always find out where the where the cubs are.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing with classified ads. It's very hard to do that from the other again. Same thing with ads.
Right.
Same thing with comics. Same strip over and over again each day, a little different. So one way, I have no idea, I'm just suggesting this, you might think of survival, but do you think of something you could provide which wasn't new? Because news changes dramatically, so it's just a source of news. But something maybe more educational, where it's a constant, something with constant value, which is always there and changes a little from day to day, and you teach people to go to it as a resource, a continuing resource. It's hard to provide on cable or on the internet some service. And then in science, of course, we have. That's what universities do. And we can teach people.
Uh-huh.
And there's a lot of stuff that isn't new, but this audience sounds like it might be very interesting.
Well, if you had the resources to do more things, you could imagine things, I think, that are along the lines you're talking about, to be part of the whole package. When you don't have the resources even to do a lot of the really frontline main things that are happening out there that should be reported, you really can't divert them to things like that are kind of like frosting or gravy or extra neat stuff to add into the package, but you got to have a package to put them into. I don't think they'd stand on their own very well or maintain or sell much for you. I don't have any. I think it'd be fine, but it has to be part of a package that, where it's sports, you'd be like, okay, you got all the agate type with all the trades and stuff, but you don't write about any of the games or anything like that, then it wouldn't work. It has to be part of a big package. So, it's just a limitation in what we can do, but then some of that stuff would be, pretty labor intensive too. I think it doesn't distort the focus. I think it just further shrinks the resources. There are, unless we're talking about something like, Rupert Murdoch, which is, a non-trivial thing, I guess. For the most part, the corporate ownership problem is not a problem getting down at the level of the content of what you do. But it is a serious problem with the level of the resources you have to do it. So it's like the Tribune Company, which owns the Chicago Tribune, the Newsday, and the LA Times. That controls some big papers with lots of people, and that company is dedicated to trimming out as much as they can trim out to keep the money what they want it to be, and that really hurts down at the level of people trying to do things, especially the things like science, which are things that need more resources in a time when you're just going to get nothing but less resources. So I've never encountered any real problem from a corporate level standpoint in terms of content. It's more in terms of procedures, resources, and things like that. And maybe in some other arenas it might be a problem, but in science there's just not that much awareness from high up about what's going on at that level. Yeah, back in the back.
So I know it's a small part of the problem that you're talking about, but I was curious about the embargo issue, because I always thought the idea of the embargo was to preserve the newsworthiness of the event or publication. But it sounds like you guys don't particularly care about it.
Well,
and find it a nuisance. So
There are some people who like that. Okay, there are some science journalists who like that because they don't have to worry about anybody else beating them to the story because they can just sit around and wait and get the stuff from the journal right to you. And that gives them that newsworthiness. But, you know, it's just as newsworthy to say it's going to come out next week as it is to say it came out today. It, you can get around that problem. I mean, like the physics guys will send me a thing, this is going to be published in Physical Review Letters next month, but we got the paper now. You want it? I say, yeah, and I can write a story and say, this is so new, it's not even published yet. You know, it's like that you can deal with. The real point from our point of view is just getting access to it. The journals, though, want to have this control of their, from their standpoint, to have their name in the paper every Thursday or every Friday. They've carved up the days, you see. You know, Nature has Thursday and Science has Friday. And PNAS used to, you know, change its schedule around so they could come out on Tuesday, which would be the same time as the New York Times Science section. So their stuff is all released for Tuesday. And, you know, several years ago, JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, was published on Friday. They weren't getting enough coverage because the stories in Science were getting all the science space on. So they switched so they'd come out on Wednesday because nobody had Wednesday. So their concern is controlling that flow and having this set up kind of an artificial way to, big news coming out today in our journal. And, you know, yeah, there are some science journalists who think that system works fine for them. They don't have to. If they know they're supposed to write a story, every Thursday or Friday, they know they can just go to the journal and get it, and don't have to worry about somebody else doing it first. And that's fine. But that's not good journalism. That's just expedience. And it's really a conflict between the journals wanting to kind of manipulate news coverage and the.
But there are examples.
Blown out of proportion. Yeah.
Is caught by the community long before publication, whereas Nature and Science have been implicated in a lot of scandalous scientific stuff, which, if under an open procedure, would never have gotten.
Well, I think that's basically right. It is a better system that way. And of course, some science journalists just don't really appreciate this, but I mean, the good ones do. Just because stuff gets published in a peer-reviewed journal, even a prestigious one, that doesn't make it any good necessarily. Well, Physical Review Letters has a couple of examples I could cite. By Refringence of the Universe.
Yeah, that was never archived.
Well, no, but it was published in Physical Review Letters.
Yeah,
but anyway.
Right. And that was a very wonderful case because there was a fight with the editor. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Never, during the 3-year period, it never circulated.
Yeah.
Once it was published, it took 2 weeks before.
Anyway, right with something.
One quantitative question. You said that sports is as popular or less popular than science.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to hear some numbers. So, for example, if I go to the most Sports Illustrated compared to Scientific American, the circulation, or hits, the average hits,
I'm referring mostly to readership surveys, and of course they vary widely depending on who you're talking to and how you ask the questions. There, I was looking at some numbers the other day, and I think this was the Pew Foundation, which does a lot of the surveys. But so sports came in at like 25% saying very interested in reading sports. Health came in at 26%, and science and technology came in like maybe it was 23%. But if you'd lumped science, technology, and health together, which is what I'm talking about, it would have been above sports. And I've seen lots of other. If you ask it a little differently, you know, are you somewhat interested? Okay, well, in surveys I've seen like that, well, you can get, if you say science, medicine, environment, then you get up in the 70s, and if you say somewhat interested, sports might be up 50, maybe 60. I mean, there's no real good, clear-cut, absolute numbers, but there's various. If you do similar comparisons of similar kinds of questions, then reader interest is always going to come out above sport for things like science and medicine will rate higher than sports, or at least, you know, as high or comparably high in some situations.
Okay, the second question was about what is the profile of a science editor, a generic science? How long does he stay in his job? Does he like to stay many years of his life?
Yeah.
Is something along the trajectory which he wants to get rid of? How does it go?
Some of us have been trying to escape, but in newspapers, there are actually very few science editors. There are many editors who have responsibility for science, but they're not particularly science editors themselves. They have other responsibilities. Science is stuck in there. So there are only a few. I mean, the biggest papers like the New York Times and the Washington Post, LA Times, our paper, and, you know, a few other papers, probably Boston Globe, papers like that, have people who are dedicated science editor jobs. And most of the time, those are people who just were editors of some sort or another, and that job got open, and that's how they became science editor, and they're looking to move on to some other science editor, some other editing job that's even better, and not too many of them stick around very long. It's different for the writers. The science writers, on the other hand, are largely people who get in the science writing job and stay in that job for years and years and years. And it's flipped a lot. In 30 years ago or so, maybe it was 10% of those people had science backgrounds and 90% of them had some journalism job and got into science writing. Today it's totally flipped. The people becoming the new science writers today, probably 90% of them have significant science backgrounds and only a few of them just out of the blue get into science writing. So their backgrounds are now much more in science. They're more likely to have gone through a science degree program and then gotten to some science journalism master's level program of some sort, gotten some internships and then gotten into a job, and they stay in those jobs. There's any time in a newspaper science writing job comes open, there's a musical chairs game where somebody goes after and gets it, and then some other spot opens, and it's quite competitive. Yeah.
About your suggestion about science restaurants, actually, in fact, in San Francisco, there was a restaurant by the name E equals MC squared.
Very good.
Menus, classical menu and quantum menu.
Very good. Well, that is the flaw in the problem. Thank you.
How does your account of what seems to be adult in science journalism, how does that square with the fact that sales of popular science books and TV documentaries suggest that people are increasingly interested in science at a non-trivial level?
Oh, people are definitely increasingly interested in a non-trivial level, and there is some good stuff, but there is not near a lot of the stuff that is done isn't so good because there aren't, you know, the resources and the ability to do it. The books is easy to explain. The publishers have figured out that if they give authors this really minuscule advance, they can put out a book, sell it to like libraries, make a little bit of money. If they do enough of those books, they'll make enough money. The authors get nothing, but you get a flood of science books, of which a lot of them are really bad. I get all of these in. Well, his is bad for a different reason. Well, some of them, but for every one of those, and believe me, they're stacked in my office. Yeah. Well, people, yeah, I can't, they don't, well. The books, it's economics. The books is economics. But it is, right, the people are interested in reading. I mean, that's true. The interest is out there. But the books aren't journalism, and that's kind of a different thing. The journalism in the media that does science does not, it's like I'm saying, okay, the level of interest for science is high, higher than sports or at least comparable to sports. The resources that the newspaper gives to covering science is, you know, 5% of what it gives to sports. So that's where the problem is. And the problem, that wouldn't be so bad if you were in a growth area and my 5% were getting bigger. But you're in a crunch time and we're at the top of the list to get cut. And so that's why I think the prospects for better and more science journalism are reduced. Yeah?
I'm just wondering, I mean, a newspaper would seem at first glance maybe the wrong place to put science in the sense that one signature property of a newspaper is that in 24 or 48 hours, it's completely worthless. You'd be willing to wipe, you know, use it as toilet paper.
Less than that.
Whereas science, for the most part, most science is going to be just as interesting a month later, whereas most sports or politics and so forth is completely dated in 24, 48 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, no, I think that's not wrong. I think that's why I don't really think you need to have as much science coverage as sports. I just think the ratio is too much out of whack. And that the newspapers can do a number of things. A, they can alert people to stuff going on that they can then seek out other sources of information for that they wouldn't ordinarily come to their attention. B, newspapers can help, you know, get word out about what's going on in science to a broader audience of people who would not go anywhere else to seek things. And, you know. If they hear something on...
Comment, though, in some sense, if one was to focus on, in newspapers, on the science that's very, that becomes dated quickly, I don't know, there might be some subsections of science that somehow has more of a story to it, or the latest drug, say, for something, which next week it'll be outdated.
That's a lot of...
People would all go to it, let's say.
Yeah, well, that's a lot of what happens in the daily news coverage, but I don't think that's really good because it's so out of context, and that the real problem with newspaper science coverage is you have this study comes out today that says this, and it's presented like, wham, here's some new fact out of the blue, and it's not put in the context of how it fits into all of what's going on in science. That's why we like to do stuff in the Monday section that puts pieces together that try to tell people, okay, here's something you heard on the radio or saw on TV, but it's really part of this bigger picture that you don't really understand unless you know something that went on before and something that's also going on over here, and put it together. Newspapers can do that a lot better than TV can do it. See, I would say what you're saying is really applicable to TV, because unless somebody, you know, sits themselves down for, you know, a half hour or an hour in Nova and forces himself to watch it, you just get little glimpses and things on TV. Whereas in a newspaper, you can pick up a paper and read it and think about it and stuff like that.
Well, let me ask the last question. since all of us in this room think that the ship of science journalism should stay afloat, what can we do to help?
Excellent question. It never hurts to express opinions to newspaper management. So anybody in your, you know, wherever your local community is, to write a letter, I don't mean like a letter to the editor necessarily to appear on the letters to the editor page, but to write a letter to the managing editor of the paper saying that you think it's important, or, you know, if you see something good in the paper is the best opportunity to say, this is really good, it'd be great if you did more of it, there'd be a lot of support from the community and a lot of interest in this. It never hurts. I mean, it doesn't go very far, but it certainly helps to have that kind of goodwill kind of sense among the people making the decisions. Because when it comes down to things like, okay, you know, do we need this or not? Knowing that there are people out there who would care if you cut something does make a difference. The other thing I think is, you know, if you encounter somebody with a lot of money who's interested in, you know, a scientifically literate public and a scientifically aware public and good communication of science generally, make the point that there could and should be a lot better science coverage, more and better science coverage in the media if people with resources understood how they could manipulate the media to do that. And that's, you know, buying advertising. I've talked to people, you know, like corporations and things that are scientifically oriented that think, yeah, you know, newspapers should do more science. And it never occurred to them that if they bought advertising and said they wanted it specifically to be in the science section, that that would help the science coverage get more resources. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, I tell this to people who, you know, are at the top of the corporation and say, yeah, that's really great. But the people who make all the decisions are the ad managers down at the lower levels who they never communicate and they just buy stuff because they're selling the product, not thinking about helping science journalism. But I mean, I think that is something that is just not generally known, that if people who think there should be better science coverage in the media, there is a way with money to influence it. And the only other thing is, you know, just this, the whole principle of cooperating and helping and being alert to the needs of the media. The people, the science journalists out there, really more than anything else, want to write good, new, interesting stories about science. And if they do that and do it well, I think it accrues to the benefit of science. And so, you know, think up ways of helping get the information to people, to cooperating, things like inviting the media to your conferences, that sort of thing. That's very good. That's very helpful. So, I mean, I don't know. If I had really good answers, I wouldn't be so desperate as I am right now. But anyway.